Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two traveling companions. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi.
I'm going to throw up a spoiler warning almost immediately on this one, because I know that some of the people out there who have been eagerly anticipating the movie we're going to be talking about before midnight don't want to know anything about the lives of Jesse and Celine as they may or may not exist 9 years after the events of Before Sunset. So if you don't want to know anything, don't listen to this podcast right now, because literally the entire podcast will be about the Before series of films. And yeah, it's going to be pretty hard to keep from spoiling some things. So consider this an all-around spoiler warning for Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, and Before Midnight. Okay, now that we have that out of the way, anyone who's still with us, make sure to give us a rating on iTunes, come and check it out, and comment on us. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, visit the website and leave a comment on the post for this podcast, or email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. That being said, let's get into our primary discussion topic. We're going to be talking about Before Sunrise and Before Sunset before getting into our feature review of Before Midnight. So let's kick it off. First of all, when did we see these films? Did we have to endure the long wait that people who've been with the series from the beginning have had to? Or have we been able to mainline them thanks to the miracle of modern technology? And what was our reaction to them? So Nick, why don't you kick us off?
Okay.
Right.
I feel like sort of a fraud, a cheat, because I only saw these movies a few months ago. I actually watched them both the day after Before Midnight had premiered at Sundance, and Jordan, our esteemed site runner person and past guest on this show, you know, was going, oh, you gotta see him, and I was like, I'll see him sometime eventually. And then Before Midnight premiered, and people were so excited, and then the people who were so excited had their expectations fulfilled, and oh, it was just such an extravagant thing. And then I thought, okay, first one is free on Amazon Instant, second is like $3, let's do this. So I watched them, and I thought they were great, really loved them. You know, so obviously, no, there was not a very long wait. I saw the film yesterday, which... for those who don't know, it would be June 8th. Watch the movies January 25th, January 20th, something like that. So it was not 9 years. It was not even 5 months. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how it would affect. I have a feeling it would change my opinion on this movie a bit more if I had waited.
Before Midnight.
Yes. I have a feeling I would feel a little differently toward it. We can get into that. But I did like that approach. I did appreciate that approach.
And Danny, what was your experience with these first two films like? Did you have a long wait between them?
No, I didn't. I had a very similar experience, actually. I probably first saw them about a year ago, or maybe a little past a year. And they were both on Netflix Instant at the time. So it was a similar thing where one night I just watched them back to back. And I think, like, in my head, the movies almost, because I watched them back to back, maybe they almost stood kind of together as, like, one thing. And so I don't know if I was really, like, kind of swelled with anticipation for Before Midnight or, like, itching to see the next film. I was just kind of satisfied with watching those two films, and I really liked them. I think as I've kind of drifted away from them a bit, I've been intrigued by where they were sort of made within Linklater's filmography. Because I think, like, if you look at Before Sunrise, it was made right after Slacker and Dazed and Confused. And it seems to me like an interesting film for him to make there, because it is sort of informed by this generational sort of angle, but it's much more intimate to me. It has, obviously, it doesn't have an ensemble So I'm kind of intrigued by how it differs from those two films. And then also, if you look at Before Sunset, kind of coming after experimental movies like Waking Life or even Tape, and I like both of those films quite a bit. It's interesting that he would then go back to Before Sunset, maybe kind of like a return to form or sorts. So, like both of the films, and did not see them, you know, when they came out, respectively.
Right. I actually got to see both of these films maybe 3 weeks ago. And I saw them at a friend's house, and he has a little theater set up in his basement. And there was only like a 15-minute intermission between the two films. And yet, I found the wait between them to be almost unbearable. Because, I mean, the first film ends on such like a kind of a perfect note. You've spent, and this is going to sound like a knock, but it's not. You've spent a very long time with these people, and you feel the weight of that time with them. And you want them to succeed as a couple. You were hoping that they will meet at that train station 6 months after the events of that movie. And then it was like, I wanted to watch it immediately. It was like mainlining a television show on Netflix. It's like, I know it's right there. I can watch the next one. And so the 15-minute wait was interminable. Like, it just never seemed to end. And I was so happy when I was able to play the next film. And then when it was over, I realized that I had to wait 2 weeks for the newest film. And I was upset. I was legitimately upset. Like, I wished that I had just waited until the day that I saw Before Midnight to watch these other two. Because in my mind, there hasn't been a movie that really does enough or does as much to really ground me in and make me root for two characters who seem to be, if not perfect for one another, then very complementary to each other. And yeah, it was difficult to wait, man. It was really upsetting. So I was happy to be able to go and see this film as soon as I did, because I just needed to know if those two crazy kids could make it work. And I avoided spoilers for it like the plague, and that really paid off for me, thankfully. But I guess the bigger question coming into Before Midnight would be, I mean, watching the two films with them and seeing the way they interact and the way that they changed and the way that they still kind of held on to one another. I mean, were you rooting for them to make it? Did you think that they would make it? What was your opinion of their romance? Because it's kind of all built on this one night that they spent together. And it's a romantic idea that they might make it work. But at the same time, did it seem at odds with whatever pragmatism you might have? Like, what were your expectations going off of these two movies into Before Midnight?
I think that Before Sunset is such a good sequel, not just a good film, but such a good sequel because of the way it sort of reappropriates a lot of what had happened in that movie, but stays true to the spirit of it and sort of what you liked about it in the first place, and puts it under a different context. It recontextualizes a lot of the movie in certain ways, and I think that, you know, it's funny how there was sort of like debate about the ending of Before Sunset, what happens really at the end. And I think it's actually, I mean, it's easy to say now that you've seen the third film, but I think it's actually clear as day what's happening there.
Yeah.
And I think that it's sort of, part of the reason it's clear as day is because it's so strongly informed by the first film and everything that has happened in the second film up to that point, which is sort of a more roundabout way of saying that I did buy their romance. And I mean, I think that the movie doesn't give you a lot of reason to, I don't think the first two give you a lot of reason to think the relationship wouldn't work. I think the movies are actually too optimistic to kind of be down in that way. And it informs my reading of, it somewhat informs my reading of the end of Before Midnight too. So, yeah, I mean, I found it very, that's one of the charms of the movies, too, is that they are so believable just in the way they speak and interact with one another. There's nothing about it that feels theatrical or put on, or there's not much posturing going on here.
Danny, thoughts?
Yeah, I don't really remember kind of when I was watching the two films thinking about, like, if they would stay together or what their future would be like. I think maybe part of that is just because of the structure of the films. Like, going into going into the first two films, I knew that they were kind of real-time exercises. So I don't know. In a way, I feel like the films Before Midnight is probably the most extreme in terms of filling in backstory. I feel like the first two films really force you to just kind of examine them moment by moment rather than sort of hypothesizing about the future. And so I think when I was anticipating Before Midnight, I didn't try to think too much about, you know, if it would be a happy ending or not. I was just kind of intrigued by spending another real time with them and seeing how the blanks would be filled in, because it is, I think, like I said, more extreme in that way in terms of exposition and how it handles that than Before Sunset.
Yeah, I loved Before Sunset primarily because of the way that it did handle the fallout of their relationship and their time together. And it does happen in real time. Correct? Like, I know the first one elides over some moments, but it's basically with them because it can't possibly last like the 9 hours that they're together.
Yeah.
But the second film, by going in real time and then showing them trying to kind of work their way into finally talking about the thing that they both want to talk about was fantastic. And their conversation in the car in that movie was just a brutal, painfully honest conversation. And it took me, I think it was at that moment where I realized like how much they had meant to each other and the way that their one night together had completely informed the way that they looked at the rest of the world. And it was really fantastic, because in the first movie you want them to succeed just because that's the romantic thing. And then after Before Sunset, you want them to succeed because you realize that not only were they just kind of caught up in the moment, but these people were actually in love with one another and allowed that to filter into the rest of their lives. And they'd made a go at trying to be somewhere else, but it just never worked. And so especially following that and coming into Before Midnight, I mean, I was almost prepared for even more kind of grounded conversation. Like, the romanticism had gone away, but it allowed them to more greatly pierce into what it means to be together for that long. I don't know. I know that my question was like, was I rooting for them? And I really was, but it's difficult to explain why. I think it was just the honesty in them and the way that Hawk and Delpy played them and the way that they're two very different people on very subtle levels, but they seem so similar in their desires out of other people. It's one of the most intense and realistic depictions of kind of a courtship or the act of falling in love that I've ever seen on film.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes it easy then to get behind them and hope beyond all hope that they're going to work it out, which is why it was such a terrifyingly long time to wait between the two movies. And I know people who had to wait the 9 years, not even knowing that they were waiting, because there was no statement that Before Midnight was going to come out. Like, I think that they had initially planned that they were just going to end it before sunset, correct?
I've never heard that.
I feel like I heard that somewhere, but I just don't know. Like,
I get the sense that they kind of like they take a few years off and then they like assess the situation.
I see. That's, my thing was like, the ending of the first movie was great. It was almost perfect in its open-endedness, and it's like you know, it's one of those things. You know, is the glass half full? Is it half empty? Are you a romantic or a pragmatist? Like, will this work out? And then the next film does a really fantastic job of kind of resetting that expectation and realizing the ways in which it could have gone wrong, which it did. And then it also is really pragmatic about the way that it looks at them and their choices now. And the second film seems so much faster than the other one because they're older now and they just don't have that languid period. And so it becomes kind of a race against the clock. It has a very thriller-like pace to it.
Yes. I actually, if I may issue a little plug, I did a list of the best real-time films, which is actually instigated by the release of Before Midnight a couple of weeks ago. And I talked about how, yeah, it is a very tense film. And it kind of, you know, you're watching them on a boat, for instance, and you get very nervous because you realize that the boat ride is coming to an end. And just the way they keep kind of milking this interaction to keep it going is sort of unbearable.
It is.
You know, and then you go back to the whole, I feel like, yeah, I've heard stories about people who saw I forget. Someone said that they saw the movie, and actually, when Richard Linklater's credit came up at the end, someone threw their popcorn at the screen because they were so angry that like it left them hanging. which is funny because I really, I really don't think it's vague at all what is happening there. Yeah. The last lines of the movie, and especially how they're delivered, make it very clear what is about to happen. And I imagine, if you knew that they were going to make another one in 9 years, the wait would be bad. But it was in like late 2011 when they started talking about it again. You know, that's when I feel like I'd be okay. And, you know, especially now after this title, I feel like I don't know if we need to not sure if we need to see a fourth one necessarily. So I'm not really holding my breath.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily thinking to myself, yeah, I got to see it. I feel like we're probably good,
right,
as far as that is concerned.
And I do believe that this is actually a good capstone on this.
Right, yeah.
Because from here on, like, it's the movies have portrayed just about every aspect of a relationship that you can have. Like, there's the initial meeting and the falling in love. And then there's the reconnection and the idea of, like, the new beginning. And, like, this time it's going to happen. And then this is the fallout of that. It's the question of, well, how have they done? Are they going to endure? You know, you look at them at a breaking point and the way they react and respond to that breaking point.
Oh, spoilers.
We already issued a spoiler warning.
That's right. I've been trying to.
Good Lord. Yeah. And so seeing that, I feel like this is the end. Like, I would be interested in seeing where they go from here. I like them as characters, and I'm invested in them, and it would be interesting to follow them further. And I'm sure that, you know, these people, Delpy, Hawk, and Linklater, could create something interesting. But I just don't know if it would have the same impact, because it wouldn't feel like a new situation.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what the point is. I mean, I know Julie Delpy joked that the last installment was already made, and it was called Amour. She actually said that.
So. Holy shit. That's a terrifying thought. At least Hawk, you know, we can assume finally learned French.
Yeah.
And won a Palme d'Or.
Yeah.
It's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, so I think that that's enough of a base to lay. I think we can get into our primary review of Before Midnight. So, everybody get ready for that.
Oh, we said we were going to stop. They wanted to see the ruins.
Yeah, but should we wake them up? You know what, let's do. On our way back to the airport, we can catch him.
You know we won't.
Yeah, I'm probably not.
Okay. And how did you two meet?
We met about 18 years ago. We kind of, sort of, fell in love. And a decade later, we ran into each other.
No. You wrote a book, and I read about it and went to look for it.
It's pretty romantic.
If we were meeting for the first time today on a train, would you start talking to me? Would you ask me to get off the train with you?
Of course.
This place is so full of thousands of years of myth and tragedy, and I thought something tragic was going to happen.
Still there. Still there. Gone.
So Before Midnight finds our protagonists, Jesse and Celine, on vacation in Greece. And they've just dropped off Jesse's child from his first marriage at the airport, young Hank. And Jesse gets some distressing news from his son that his son actually doesn't want him to come and visit because just the animosity between Jesse and his wife is so much that the son's worried it's going to create problems for him. And this kind of is the catalyst for a day-long conversation that brings to light a lot of the things, I guess, that were going unaddressed through the 9 years that they were together, or that had been addressed but not to satisfaction. And so it's them finally kind of breaking into the reality of their relationship and seeing where it's going to go. You know, they're at a crossroads and they just need to know what's going to happen. So what were our thoughts on Before Midnight, Danny?
Very positive indeed. The third installment of this very acclaimed series. So, like I said, kind of in my memory, the first two films sort of stand side by side. And I think what I appreciated about this film is how different it was, especially structurally. You mentioned the opening scene at the airport, and then The first long conversation between Hawk and Delpy, the kids are in the car and you can see them in the back seat. And then there's the long sequence kind of where they're staying in Greece, and there's a lot of added members to the cast. And so I appreciated how much kind of baggage was implied there about the time in between the films. And I thought it handled exposition very well. And then the second half is obviously back more in the vein of the first two films where they're walking and talking. And then eventually they get in the hotel room and have that pretty tense conversation. So it's interesting the way the first half of the film is very different, and then it sort of returns to its structure. And I think conceptually with this third installment, the series sort of takes on a grander significance, because if you just kind of look at it from a sort of film experiment standpoint, to have three installments spanning three decades with the same actors, the same director, same subject matter, it's just kind of probably something that's never really been done before in this way. And I think that's something you wouldn't get if there were just two installments. So I think if you just look at this third movie from kind of a conceptual point of view, it sort of kind of raises the stakes of the series in a way that probably has never been done before. And so I think as much as I like the film itself, I really admire what the third film does for it as a concept as well.
Nick, what about yourself?
Yes. Before Midnight, motion picture, directed by Richard Linklater, starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, set in Greece. Okay. This is kind of a complex thing here. I really like the film, but I am kind of disappointed in it.
Really?
At the same time. Yes. The first, with the exception of the opening scene, which is terrific, I found the first maybe 25, 30 minutes of this movie quite poor. And I was sort of shocked and upset sitting in the theater watching it and not enjoying it, really. There's the conversation between them in the car, which is nice, if not indicative of certain problems that will spring up later in the movie and which can be felt at that moment. But then when we return to this home and they're actually not talking to each other, this is practically a series first where they're talking to other people, I start to ask myself how compelling I actually find these characters outside of when they're interacting with each other. And then there's this dinner scene, which I was just very troubled by. I really did not enjoy that sequence at all. I found, maybe this is part of the point, I found the two of them almost unbearable in that sequence. It was very strange. They seemed very irritating, and they kind of reminded me of like my mom's friends, sort of, which is not a compliment at all, I assure you. They reminded me of people who come over to my house and I'm like, oh, fuck you, get out of my home.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, your father sometimes listens to this podcast.
Yeah. Well, I said my mother.
I know, but it's okay. I was just wondering if this was going to be like an awkward conversation.
Okay.
Like,
yeah, no, I tend not to like her friends, so okay. I think she knows that too.
All
so
right.
it's cool.
That's fine. We're good.
Anyway. And then there's a hard cut to the two of them walking together, and it was as if someone just blew, you know, cold air into a 100-degree room. It was just sort of this huge relief, and then finally the film proceeds, and it begins to feel more like the before films that I have come to enjoy so greatly. And it proceeds, and by the end of the movie, I would say I'm with Danny, where I appreciate it more as a third film, and I think it works stronger as that. As a standalone, yes, it is good, but I do think that it is by far unquestionably the most problematic of the series, and I think it is a step down, unfortunately. That being said, the way I would put it is that I'm not at all a fan of giving out grades for movies because it's a stupid system.
Right.
But pretty much everybody I know has been throwing out the A's for this one. You know, doling out the A's for Before Midnight for these two love-struck sorts. for me, it's probably a B plus. Okay. And I feel like kind of a jerk saying this, but I just kind of wanted more from it. Either that or this film is not exactly what I wanted. And I am definitely being selfish in saying that, not being fully appreciative of what was delivered, because it is still good, but it's not quite there.
I have to agree with you about the dinner scene.
Okay.
I actually didn't mind up until that point. I thought that their conversation in the car was good. It was.
Yes, I have to. Later, I can get to the problem that it sort of opens up for me.
Okay.
Even though I did like the scene, it does kind of. Yeah, a later issue will sort of flow out of that. But okay. Please continue. Yes.
Thank you. No, like I liked their conversation in the car. I felt like it was a good way to fill in backstory on both where they are in life and where they are in terms of their relationship. When they got to the villa, I don't know what the Greeks call them, but when it got
probably
there,
something with a lot of O's and P's and an S.
True, it definitely ends in an S, whatever it is. But when they got there, I actually was okay with them being apart. And I felt this really intense sense of, like, dread. It was almost like a horror movie. Like, I was sure that something was going to go wrong. I was sure there was a problem that was going to bubble to the surface, because the conversation in the car had kind of primed me for this tension between them. And so I was fine with it when they were, you know, talking with their friends and helping to prepare the dinner. But when it got to the dinner, there was a kind of obviousness to the conversation that was unsettling for me.
Yes.
There was also a deep-seated cynicism in what most of the people were saying that I guess was just outside of my comfort zone, because I'm not that cynical, surprisingly, about love and relationships. And so whenever Bohemians start talking about, you know, the impossibility of lifelong love or, you know, stuff like that, kind of grates on me the wrong way. But then when you said, like, when it makes the hard cut to them walking and talking and getting back to themselves and kind of finally kicking into the gear of the before films that we're used to, I was happy about that. And I thought that it did pay off a little bit on some of the earlier stuff, but that dinner conversation still felt really out of nowhere to me. Like, bizarrely out of nowhere.
So, actually, do you have more initial impressions? Or?
I guess that's about it. I would still give it an A, especially...
Really?
Especially when compared.
Wow.
Jesus. All right. Whoa.
Solid Nick on that one.
But I think that my A is contingent upon it being a continuation of the other ones.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that the unevenness of tone would cause it to be like a B for me, were it any other film. But because it does, it draws so well on the other two. And it feels like most sequels, like the characters just kind of change arbitrarily. Like, John McClane is not who he used to be. And I like the fact that this movie is a continuation of character that works, and it's good. And it's just a truth to it. There's a truthfulness to the way that people, like, mature or don't mature or change or don't change that I liked. And I loved that final thing, that when they're in the hotel room. I've been in a lot of fights, guys. A lot of fights with... people that I've been in relationships with, and that was difficult for me to watch because of the commonness of all of everything. And I'm just like, wow, my problems and apparently the problems of everyone who's ever been in love and wants to, you know, make it work are all the same. Down up to and including just the whole you're being illogical, can we talk about this rationally through the facts. That is always the worst thing you can say, but it sometimes feels like the only thing you can say.
Yeah.
Because you lose track of that so quickly. And so almost because of that alone, and because of the fact that it's not your usual histrionic, like, yelling and trying to hurt one another just because that's kind of convenient to the plot, but there is a lot of... There's animosity, but at the same time, it's animosity bred out of insecurity related to the relationship in the future. It's not hatred for the people, it's hatred for the thought of what they could do to you, or maybe have done to you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a difficult and complex idea to get across, and they did it really well in this film.
Very good scene, although I did like it more when it was in Eyes Wide Shut. I will say that. The scenes are very similar.
They are. They are kind of similar. There's no crazy weed in this scene, though.
Yes.
There's no Nicole Kidman acting like she just took a shot of Everclear when she just took like one toke off of a roach. But her high acting, this is not related to that film, this film at all, but I mean, her high acting in that scene is ridiculous.
Mm,
yeah. And I assume that she has been high before and she should have known better, but...
Yes. Anyway.
So yeah, that's my initial impression.
Okay.
I still give it an A.
So, okay, so two problems that kind of come from that scene. One is, this is something I had not thought of at all after I had sort of heard what the kind of the deal was with this movie when it premiered at Sundance, but actually became sort of a concern when I had read a review by a critic I like who had noted that there is a sort of an insurmountable issue with this movie kind of trying to maintain a certain tempo because, you know, the first film, they've never met before. The second film, they haven't seen each other since the last time they were on screen together. The third film, they've been together for 9 years. And so there's a lot of history that's between them now that we are not privy to. And in the second film, the way they sort of expound this personal history is to just kind of talk to each other. And we are hearing it for the first time along with another character. Here, though, I feel as if there's an extra layer of remove from the action because suddenly they're talking about all these things. They're talking about these people and these incidents that have happened in years past, and we are not necessarily with them anymore. It creates a different dynamic, the sort of the idea of which I appreciate, but I found that the way it was actually delivered through the dialogue, although naturalistic, yes, was kind of not fitting for what this series is trying to do. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts, reactions to that.
Yeah, sure.
Please.
Go for it.
So, yeah, I think there is that point that needs to be made about how much baggage has happened in between Before Sunset and Before Midnight. And I found, actually what I found satisfying about this film, and something I wasn't necessarily expecting, was how much the discussion revolves around their professional lives rather than their personal lives. There's and I think that's something you couldn't have had in the first two films because they didn't have an ongoing relationship and they weren't talking about, you know, spending their lives together. And this film kind of takes very seriously the idea of the difficulty inherent in just marriage and profession. If you have two spouses that both want their dream jobs and you have kids in different countries. And so I found a lot of the discussion about their work very worthwhile and valuable. And I especially found the portrait of an author more interesting here than I did in Before Sunset. I think something about Ethan Hawke in Before Sunset publishing a book about a fling came off as a little cliche to me. Mm-hmm. But I think this film handles it more complexly, where I like the conversation he has before the dinner scene with these other guys about this idea for a book he has, and kind of what the characters he talks about reveals about his own life. And I also thought, yeah, Brian, this is probably something you could talk about too.
Oh, yeah.
Because, yeah. So I'll say one more thing and then I'll pass it off. But I also liked how that sort of doubles back on him in the argument when she sort of resents his lifestyle. And, you know, that his sort of artistic passion is probably one of the reasons she fell in love with him. But now you have her kind of turning the tables and saying, it's all bogus. Like, you take these walks. What do you even do? And so, yeah, that's something I would say about the film, is the discussion of profession.
Yeah, the discussion of profession was actually really interesting for me, especially, you know, I'm a young professional, I guess is how I'm being classified now. And it's a tough, especially if you're in a relationship, and especially, you know, if you're in any kind of mobility in your job or between jobs or looking for a job. Like, you know, you're with someone and you say to them one day, you know, my current job is awful, I think I need to find a new one. You're not just changing your life, you're changing the entire dynamic that you've built together. And I guess a lot of people don't realize that or understand it at first, because they seem to make it say, like, oh, it's a really easy change. I'm just going to be going to this other place now. It's like, okay, well, that's going to cut into the time, and we have a very balanced schedule as it is, and it's rough, and it's tough. And again, it's not something that gets brought up a lot in movies. It gets brought up very obviously in Revolutionary Road, but even it's more modern here, obviously, because in Revolutionary Road, you know, you have the man going off and winning the bread and then coming home. Whereas in this, they're both working and they're both raising children and they're both kind of making little mental checklists. And this is something that I've experienced a lot. You constantly are keeping tally of who's giving up more or who's putting more in. And you're only viewing it against the prism of what's important to you and what you're doing. And I've actually had that conversation, the writerly conversation. I mean, like what you said, Danny, the first film is kind of like an author wish fulfillment thing. You know,
yeah, I think that's a bit of a reaction I had as well.
Because I saw it and I was like, I've had so many dreams about that, like going to some place and doing a book signing and people asking me questions. And every time I finish a short story and people read it, almost the immediate question is like, so did this happen to you? Or like, is this person based off of someone?
Mm-hmm.
And in the first movie, it just seemed kind of indelicate the way that they made that out and the way that it was played out. And in this film, I did like the more asinine, kind of pretentious aspect of being an author, which is making the idea and then bouncing it off of people. I'm in the middle of a book that I'm writing right now, and I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people where I tell them what the plan is and I tell them who the characters are, and then it's just a barrage and a back and forth, and it's like, well, I think that it sounds a little pretentious, or I think that this character sounds unreasonable, or they want to know what's going to happen and why a character would do something. And it's just, it was a fun scene to watch and be a part of, because on a very much smaller and less important scale, it's something that I go through nearly constantly. And yeah, so that was good. I liked that a lot. And again, just the truth in their actions and the way that they fight with one another was just really difficult to get through. It's such a hard movie to be a part of. But I do agree with what Nick was saying about the kind of strangeness and remove that this movie
that
does.
Being said,
yes.
That being said, am I wrong in thinking that the characterization of Celine here is hugely problematic?
And I was going to mention that.
Well, it depends on how you think it's problematic. Did we lose Nick?
Granted, this depends upon. Hello.
No, you're there.
Hello?
You're fine.
Okay. Granted. Again, time has passed, and these are not exactly the same people per se, but I did find that this is the second problem that had stemmed from that scene when she talks about how he makes a suggestion, and she says, well, I'm marking this as the end of our relationship. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, let's slow down here for a second. This is not at all the kind of characterization that she had been given in the two prior movies.
Really?
And I don't think it is. I think that it is so reactionary. And it strikes me, it's not just that this is a problem, it's that it continues throughout the film. And I found in the argument that, I mean, yes, as a male, perhaps it is easier to side with the male in that debate, but I did find that it was too one-sided. I found that Jesse was so much more agreeable in that. When he wasn't really saying anything, it didn't feel as if he was saying anything that was too outside the bounds of decency or acceptability. It felt as if Celine was almost looking for a fight this moment.
And it's true. And I did. It was a major concern of mine because, again, I've been in that fight. And I imagine constantly that an outsider looking in would see me. And again, this could be male ego or just ego to begin with. But they'd see me and they'd hear my very agreeable statements and be like, that guy seems to have a level head on his shoulders. What's the girl's problem? But here's the thing. I mean, in the first movie, when they're talking, she mentions how when her grandfather died, he told her that he had a relationship with another woman and like another family. Mm-hmm. So, and then you juxtapose that against Jesse, who has just learned that his grandmother died, I believe. Grandmother or grandfather.
Yeah.
I think it was the grandmother, because the grandfather had died previously, and it was only a few months before the grandmother died. And they have to go back for the funeral, but there was never a funeral for his grandfather because their plan was to be cremated, have their ashes mixed, and then be buried together. So you have two different people coming from two very different situations. She has had her idealism about romance and love broken, and she even kind of mocks her children and how every story ends with a marriage, even though there is no marriage. Like, they'll see, like, you know, two characters, like, beat an evil witch, and then it'll end, and they'll just say, like, oh, and they got married. Because to her, that's kind of a youthful ideal that just doesn't work anymore. Like, it's not going to work out. And so in the back of her head, she has this idea, like, this guy is going to leave me, he's going to cheat on me, it's not going to work out. And so her saying that actually kind of really works for her character, because she does feel that way. She does have that sense that, like, this won't end well, and it will end, and I'm just waiting for that. And I think that she isn't looking for a reason for it to end so much as she's just trying to get ahead of it ending. She doesn't want to be blindsided by it. She doesn't want to wake up one day and realize that she put all this investment into something that's not there. And so when all this is happening, she keeps trying to turn it into the thing so she can know that is the thing.
See, I had this conversation on Twitter yesterday, and someone who I spoke to made basically the same point, and I said, I don't disagree with that at all. I don't think you're wrong in that assessment. I just don't think the application here is very comfortable or organic. She comes across as kind of a harpy, and that bothered me because in Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, it's a very three-dimensional, understandable, entirely likable, purely likable character. And I think of her scene in the inside the car where they're talking to each other, and at that moment she's speaking, and everything she's saying is very, it's easy to grasp. You can understand where she is coming from in her concerns. None of the concerns feel unprecedented or unjustifiable. They all feel organic to the texture of the story and the interaction. But past that, I did think that what is happening here is a different person. And this speaks to the problem of the movie, which is that there's a 9-year remove. And so when we're dropped into this again, it is not the same. But the movie kind of tries to have its cake and eat it too, I think, with that. And again, I really like this movie. Should I say that again?
Okay.
Should I add that I'm a big fan of it and that it would, you know, it is currently on my 2013 top 10, at least. Maybe I should just reiterate that so I don't sound like a total jerk poo-pooing a movie that everybody likes. Yes, but I do think that the way that it is organized here does not really speak to what the series kind of has stood for and what it has been going for in past efforts.
Danny, you were going to say something?
Yeah, just to defend a little bit how Celine is characterized in that hotel room scene. I think one of the things that's powerful about that scene is that you have them kind of in this room alone, and they're sort of going there with the expectation, and especially the people that bought them the room gave them the room with the expectation that they'll go there and have this great night and connect, and it'll be, you know, stress-free. But they're at kind of this point in their lives where their just overall life situation is, like, greater than their relationship. So even when they're kind of cut off like this, they're sort of in a place where they can't forget about their problems. And I think one of the things that comes out of that is this characterization of Celine as sort of like a pronounced feminist. And the situation is basically that they both have their jobs, and Jesse wants to move to be with his son, and which would require her to give up her job. And she's basically just like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I feel like that's sort of like a tough, really tough decision, because standard notions are that, you know, even if she is a feminist and wants to have this individual life, some kind of maternal instinct will kick in. She'll be like, okay, yes, let's move. But she's basically just like, no, And that sort of really makes the scene like tough, and it makes her character tough in a way where I could see it would off-put someone. But like a lot of things in this film, I think it is kind of an organic outgrowth of both her character and just the added baggage.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's especially true because, like we said earlier, she made a mention of the fact that he goes on like a 2-hour long walk. And like, it's part of his process, and that's what he has to do. Like, I again, drawing from my own personal life, like the times when I sit in a room alone or go out and, you know, have a drink on the patio and I just don't want to talk to anyone, those are the times that I have probably caused the most problems in a relationship. Because there's this sense of like the introversion and the aloneness. That's not a word. I'm not a writer. Jesus. the solitude that goes along with it. You're removing yourself. And it seems like it's an indulgence, but it's really not. But to a person who doesn't see that and who doesn't know it and live with it, I mean, that looks like a problem that you're having. And because his job allows him mobility like that, there doesn't appear to be a sacrifice on his end. And so it's not so much the idea of doing it as it is the ease of him doing it and his expectation that it would be easy for her as well. You know, like, if again, it's the little mental checklists that we make, the little tallies that we hold, and the scoreboards that we keep, where it's like, well, I'm going to move my whole life, you know, from Europe to America and have to find a job over there, and this asshole is just going to be able to pick up his shit and go there and still write.
And do you think that her outlook on the situation is truly justifiable, though, given the circumstances and given the situation?
I mean, sort of. I was kind of on her side. Like, I understood where she was coming from. Like,
see, I guess part of this is that the movie feels so calibrated, so strongly calibrated, that for any part of this to not kind of be, for me to not be on its wavelength in every regard, can kind of throw off the balance very easily, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I'm focusing far too much on this issue in a movie that's still very good. But it's a problem that I have seen others raise, but I feel as if it's not coming up enough. And I feel like it's very obvious. It's very obviously an issue. But maybe, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure exactly why I had that reaction to her behavior. It just seemed far too reactionary and unhealthy.
Well, I mean, again, I can see that. Unfortunately, I've been in that situation, and I know that's how it goes.
Yes, but that doesn't mean the other person is correct.
No, it doesn't. But I mean,
it doesn't mean it doesn't mean that the scripting of her like so is necessarily proper.
I think it is correct for her character.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way I feel. I get the impression that she's not like this usually, like that this is a breaking point that has been brought up, because you find out that she didn't even want to really come to Greece, like that wasn't her idea.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so again, you're meeting, you see this, okay, well, the entire podcast is spoilers, so I can say it, like towards the end, you know, they do this little play acting where she puts on like the dumb blonde voice, and I feel like that's what they're used to, that openness and that warmth and that love and that understanding. And that's what they had to get back to. And so all of this was like an aberration that had to be worked through to get them back to that. And I feel like they did a good job of keeping these characters inside of the lines that they'd made in the previous films, but just, you know, coloring with darker colors and like different shades and, you know, changing them enough through the stress of the situation and the intensity of what they were talking about that it made sense. I don't know.
Okay. I have been in conversations like the one at the end. So
the one where she's pretending to be a dumb blonde?
No. I mean, I've had arguments like the one, the climactic one.
Yeah, I was going to actually ask, because a friend of mine who had listened to the To the Wonder podcast that we did had asked me about you two and your romantic lives, because he was trying to think if someone who'd...
Well, let me sit him right down.
And tell him all the story. No, well, my wonder was... To the Wonder.
Wondrous film.
The Wonder... Gee, why do I have to keep saying that bloody word? Why did I just say bloody? Oh, God. I need to go to bed. The thought was, if a person hasn't been in an experience like that, or hasn't experienced a situation like that, might it be harder for them to connect emotionally? So I was wondering if you two had been in a long-term committed relationship that came to an argumentative point like the one in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hadn't, did you feel any removed from that, or did it make you really dread the day when you'd eventually have to have that conversation?
No, it didn't make me dread. I don't think so.
Okay, but you just said you'd been in conversations like that.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't... I guess watching this movie, it was something I appreciated. I appreciated the sort of the verisimilitude in how it's depicted.
Mm-hmm.
Very beat by beat, kind of feels like it will never end, going in circles. You feel as if your point is bracingly clear, and yet you're still there arguing.
Yep. That's my favorite part of any argument.
From recent experience, I can tell you, yes, it definitely nails that very well.
Well, Danny, what about yourself? So, what about your romantic life?
I tend to not try to put too much stock in that sort of hypothesis. That
I can't imagine Danny in an argument.
Yeah, I don't like confrontation really, but I mean, just generally speaking. And especially because I'm like 20. So if I watch a movie like Amour and I love it, I don't really know how I can look at movies generally and say that if I haven't experienced something, I won't.
If you
like the movie.
That would have been a spoiler. Never mind.
Yeah, I was going to just come back at you with a spoiler. So yeah, that's sort of something I don't tend to put too much stock in, just maybe by necessity. But obviously I really like this film, and I thought the argument hit home, even though I've never had an argument about moving countries to live with my son.
Well, neither have I. I hate my son. I don't have a son. Should make that bracingly clear. Yeah, but I mean, like, it doesn't have to be about things like that. There's just that confusion that goes into an argument. That sense of, I feel like I've illustrated this point so clearly. What are you still not getting about it? And how do I ask you that without sounding like an asshole?
Mm-hmm.
And I've never learned that. I've never learned that skill. I'm still in Ethan Hawke phase where I'm just like...
Nothing wrong with that.
Good phase.
It's a good phase.
He's in The Purge, made a bunch of money.
Talking professionally, sadly.
when do I make my... This is the podcast. This is where the podcast goes off the rails, by the way. Make my Purge jokes?
Make it right now.
Right now.
Okay, so I thought the last line of the movie, if this was the other Ethan Hawke movie that I could have seen this weekend, the last line of the movie would be, it must have been one hell of a 12 hours with legal crime we're about to have. So thank you. As I was driving home,
zing,
that sort of pops in my head. And also, for the next 12 hours, it's one hell of a night we're about to... I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
No, you're not.
What am I doing with myself?
Uh-oh. We just forced Nick into an existential moment of angst.
God. All right.
Anyway.
This movie has succeeded. It's a sign that it's a... just sort of a viscerally effective movie. This film succeeded in leaving me very, very sad, I have to say. This movie made me feel just more purely sad than almost pretty much any movie I've seen this year. And I think, which is funny, because my reading of the movie is of the conclusion is that it'll probably work out. I don't think that it really fits the series for it to end on a divorce. Or not a divorce, a separation. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really feel... I talked earlier about how my issues with Celine's characterization speaks to the texture of these movies. And I think the texture as well does not permit that sort of thing to happen. But there are people who feel otherwise. And I would like to know where you two gentlemen stand.
I would agree with you completely.
Okay. I found the ending of the movie very very sweet and very kind of strangely innocent too. There's sort of a sweetness in that, in the way he handles the situation, because he clearly, the way he handles that, I feel like it's very clear that he still loves her.
Oh yeah.
And that he loves her. He says he loves her unconditionally, and that's kind of the problem, is that it becomes more difficult to, and I understand that. I've had that feeling where you love someone unconditionally and because of that, their issues, their flaws kind of become more of a concern as a result because of what it might do for your feelings toward them.
Right.
And I guess the issue, again, is Celine, exactly how she will compose herself from here on out. And the last line of the movie, I actually think, is a much more effectively ambiguous conclusion than Before Sunset. Because, as I said, the ending of that movie feels pretty clear. The last line of this movie, I really don't know what to make of. Because it could really go in two directions, I think.
I felt like it was pretty clear.
Well, see, the thing is that yes, it might, but the problem is there's this established, the movie's very good at leading up to this point because there is this established, you kind of get the sense that she doesn't like his writing. You kind of get the sense that she doesn't respect him as an artist. And I think that the way the situation is handled by him and then the final line, sort of her delivery of it feels a little, sort of a little stinging, I think. But then again, maybe the mixing in my theater was weird or something, and it gave an unintended significance to the final line. I don't know, but it's funny. It is funny. I do think that they'll probably work it out, but at the same time, I am unclear as to exactly how the final line will resonate.
I don't know. I felt like the final line was pretty clearly a reconciliation. Yeah. And I felt like it was her responding in the same way that, you know, he obviously has the goofy, sweet, unconditional love side. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, her default is to react to that with cynicism, but in a loving way, if that's possible.
Sure. Okay. No, yeah. People who know me know that they can tell you that it's a very real characteristic in a person.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm kind of the same way. Like, you know, someone says they love me and I'm like, oh, well, that the duh. Like, of course you do. Come on.
Yeah.
Jesus. But yeah, so I thought that it was pretty clear. I felt like they'd made it. They'd gone through that. And, you know, her misgivings or assumptions had been put to rest or put to bed in a way. And that it had become clear to her. And she was almost like upset that she had failed to push him away and that he had broken through and like gotten back to her. Not because she doesn't want to be with him, but just because I think that maybe she didn't want to admit to being that romantic person who wanted it to work out.
Because mm-hmm. Right. She sees herself as too much of a career woman.
Yeah. Like she assumed she's probably concerned about hurting him. She doesn't want him to hate her, which is how the entire conversation starts.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Now she sees that he's okay with it. And all that matters to him is to be with her. And all the extra things in life that work out or don't work out are ancillary to that. And I think that she's bemused by it and maybe a little frightened of it or angry about it. But only insofar as he is forcing her to admit to the fact that she wants that. Like he one of the best lines was when he says, you know, she's just like their children. She's still that little girl who wants the happy ending. And he's like, but, you know, she's probably expecting it to be like perfection and like blameless, faultless, problemless love. And he's like, but this is it. Like, this is the happy ending. Like, this is us being in love and taking one another's shit and not holding it against one another and being accepting and loving and forgiving. Like, we make the happy ending by making that choice to be in love and to make it work.
Mm. And that, well, that's beautifully put, I must say.
Thank you.
I also think that the movie I think Before Midnight is really brilliant in sort of playing the idea of, not that this is really a buried point, I think it's kind of clear, but I think that it is nevertheless brilliant in its sort of sort of the way it expounds upon the idea of the way people narrativize their lives. And because you look at this, these people have the most incredible story.
I know, right?
Like you could not devise a more incredible true to life story than this. Right.
Exactly.
And so I think that the, you know, there is sort of the issue of the way they see their lives and the perspective they're standing from. I mean, Danny, by the way, wrote a very nice piece comparing this movie to Journey to Italy and Certified Copy. So, you know, that's a sincere clap. Finally.
That's not the sarcastic clap from earlier.
No, no. Is Danny still here?
Yeah, okay. A lot of references here.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, there's the very explicit reference to, even though it's not mentioned by name, she says, oh, I saw this film as a teenager with Ingrid Bergman walking around.
Yeah,
that speaks to it very much. And I think it's interesting how, you know, he looks toward a movie like On the Waterfront, and he looks toward these books that he loves. And then she thinks of Journey to Italy, which, if a listener has not seen it, is a, you know, is not the most optimistic screen portrayal of a marriage I've ever seen, necessarily. There is that conflict there, because I think the movies have always had a very fascinating relationship to art. And the way it kind of... And, you know, right after that conversation, they go into this church and they're looking at... Not even a church, it's almost like a small
like a chapel,
prayer.
Almost.
Yeah. A small prayer area, we can call it that. Maybe.
Rectory? No, that's where they live.
Oh, okay. Well,
I don't know.
Anyway. So, yes, we get into there, and then that kind of... puts a very fine button on it. And I don't know. I guess this is probably... It speaks to why I think that this will be a good wrap-up, because I feel like it kind of says everything that needs to be said, even if I sort of feel like the series could have ended at Before Sunset and I would have been happy enough. I do like what this... It kind of goes back to what Danny said. I do like what this says about the first two movies, and... Even if, for me, it does kind of expose flaws or limitations in those films that had not been evident prior, yes, what it does do is sort of what I think every third film in a trilogy is required to do, and what most do not.
Yeah, so. I think it's a perfect wrap-up, because it like I said, it basically ends with, this is the happy ending. Like, people probably had assumptions... Like, oh, he stays, he misses his plane, and now they're going to live a wonderful, perfect, flawless life. And then they get to see this, and they get to see these two characters who, you know, found each other across time and everything. And, you know, seeing them interact and, you know, being argumentative towards one another was probably a bit of a shock. But then, you know, there's that line, you know, this is that happy ending. I'm like, okay, this is reality, man. This is how it works.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that. I liked that about the film. Any final thoughts? I wanted to ask, like, they make a point of saying that they are not married.
Yeah.
Because the girls ask, you know, when about the wedding, and they don't have anything. So, like, what do you think that in any way influences the way they act towards one another? Like, is there anything to be gleaned from that?
I just think that's another good detail about why this is kind of like a specific generation, their idea of a relationship and a marriage, and kind of her unwillingness to be pinned down and his kind of carefree attitude towards it. I think it's a detail that makes sense in there.
Yeah, I think it speaks to their characters, sort of the way they view love is kind of this, because, you know, their first interactions with each other were these very sort of pure, unfiltered things, and I think that which is actually sort of true of the second, albeit the sort of the history that the burden of history that comes with it. And I think that the not getting married is an attempt to preserve that sense of newness and kind of the feelings that it inspires in them. I think from what I could sort of glean, the idea of marriage is too inhibiting to them. They want to maintain that kind of freeness, and yet they're being dragged down by the world. They're being dragged back down to reality, which is what the movie is really about. That's sort of, I think, kind of its secret center, in a way, is when you fall in love, after you fall in love, you have to kind of... I mean, you know, I think that one of the hardest parts of a relationship is discovering the flaws in another person.
Yeah.
And learning that those are not just character tics that have come up at that moment. That is actually an ingrained part of their personality. And it does speak to the problem I have, where we don't really get to see that develop necessarily. I don't think we get to see that develop more fully when the movie kind of... The movie is very much focused on that as a piece, but Linklater, Hawk, and Delpy's script does manage to dive into that as is, where they are now. So, anyway, that's kind of a... I feel like I might have answered three questions in there. But it's just the thing about this film is that I... you know, it's a high compliment when I say that. I start to make one point about somebody, and then I find myself trailing off into a few others because it's all so interconnected.
Yeah, there's a cascading effect, and it engenders good conversation. And I think it's a perfect capstone to the series. If they do another one, though, I'll be back.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so that's our conversation about Before Midnight, which is currently playing in limited release. Doing very well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, sure. One last tidbit. You know, I walked out of the movie kind of thinking I would, kind of thinking to myself, maybe that didn't hit me as much as I was expecting. And then I got into my car, and I'm driving for 90 seconds, and what comes on the radio but the Beatles' is All You Need Is Love. It comes, yeah, I was listening, and it was something like, you know, Tom Petty or whatever. So it was kind of, you know, it's ultimate dad rock, you could say.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I hear the opening notes of it, and I'm just thinking, fuck, no. This is the worst choice. And then I was, it's sort of what drilled in the melancholy feeling that I've had since seeing the movie, is that song, which almost, it almost feels like something out of a screenplay. In a way, it doesn't feel like something that would happen in one of these movies, basically, because it is too sort of clean in that. But it was an experience I had, and I felt like that was maybe worth sharing.
All right. Well, that's my friend that I walked out of the movies with is actually a woman who doesn't, you know, she's not really believes in marriage. You know, she laughs at all of her friends who gets engaged. And, she said to me, I think they would be fine if they just didn't have children. I was like, that's a dark way to look at it, I guess. I was like, they just find other things to fight about. Like,
cute kids.
Those are adorable young children.
Yes.
Those flaxen-haired little girls. I was trying to think of like, oh, cherubs. That's the one.
They're like Aryan super beings.
Oh, shit. Now that we've called a bunch of 7-year-olds Nazis.
No, I called them Aryan super beings. That's a compliment.
Okay.
even though I am bothered by the multi-person dynamic that this movie strives for at first, credit to not including the kids. That was a very wise decision. Because that could have been a real problem, I think. I don't know if that's just me.
I would have been... It would have been weird, yes.
Yeah. I would have walked out. I'd have been like, are you kidding me? And leave the theater.
All right. So we know Danny's short fuse for films.
hates kids.
He hates kids. Him and kids are like oil and water and a stick of dynamite. So let's get into what's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray.
God, how do we move on from that deep conversation?
We talk about Lilo and Stitch 2.
And Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters.
Yeah. That's really... Oh, Wild Strawberries is coming to Blu-ray on Criterion. Mm. Running Scared with Paul Walker also coming to Blu-ray.
So... Did you almost say also coming to Criterion?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you seen Running Scared?
I have, yeah.
I like the movie a lot.
I kind of like it. I kind of dig it. It's funny, though. One of my... I took very few film classes in college just because it was hard to fit them in, and my... school had just dismantled the film program, but one of my professors loved to talk about the difficulty of scripting cursing.
Yeah,
and he would point out the differences between Deadwood's cursing and Running Scared's cursing.
Oh, because Deadwood is very poetic.
Yeah,
and very sort of intrinsic, naturalistic.
Precisely.
Whereas Running Scared
is just like fucking fuck shit. Yeah. Cunt, fuck. Yeah, it's just like, all right, we get it, Paul Walker. You're in an R-rated movie.
With his Jersey accent. Oh, yeah. Man.
Oh, God. And his name is Joey Gazelle.
That movie. That is such an evil movie, and I really like it.
I love that movie. That movie is ridiculous. A little kid, like, knifing a pimp or whatever. I don't even remember. Yes. Anyway, also coming out, House of Cards is hitting DVD. One of my friends loves to, whenever I say that like a movie or like a TV show that he likes is going to be on DVD, he's like, wow, I didn't realize that Netflix was exporting to solid state media. So I guess it's kind of weird. Like, I guess if you are going to lose your internet connection, you want House of Cards regardless. I don't know. Snitch is also coming out. The Newsroom, the complete first season, will be on Blu-ray. What was that sigh for?
It was just a sigh at the Newsroom, okay. Is what it is.
Do you like the Newsroom? Did we have this conversation?
Oh, God. Yeah, kind of. But I don't like it the way you like good things.
That's exactly how I feel about it.
Because it's not a good show. Like, it is almost decidedly not a good show. And yet, it is... It's entertaining because of the... Just the absolute mess of it, the good and the bad, and how they collide head-on into this bloody result that is the Newsroom. It's a fascinating show, and I hate myself so much for looking forward to the second season.
This is how I
feel like a
you know how
I feel
I've
like
been
a woman reading the 50 Shades of Grey novels.
Oh God,
that's kind of how I feel with the show. It's like I should know better, but
do you know? Okay, this is how I've been reacting to real world events recently. Mm-hmm. Oh, I wonder how they're gonna cover this so much better on the Newsroom.
I remember the Boston Marathon bombing when there was the whole controversy over, well, did they catch him or not? That was the...
And I was just like, I swear to God, like, there's going to be a scene where, like, the head of the network is going to be yelling at Will, just be like, CNN says they caught him. And he's going to be like, we don't run unless we get confirmation. And then it's going to be scored over, like...
Remember they scored it over Coldplay?
Coldplay, yeah. I was trying to think of a shittier band than Coldplay. I almost said Imagine Dragons. I don't know why.
I don't even know who that is.
Have you ever seen the trailer for The Host?
No.
Okay. Anyway, unimportant. Also coming out, Oz the Great and Powerful, and Wrong. So there's that.
We actually discussed House of Cards, the episode we reviewed Wrong.
We did.
Yeah, that's funny.
It's good synchronicity.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. Wrong, I will not. No, I'm not even going to say
anything
about it.
Let's not get into that. Yeah. So any of these really sticking out to us, gentlemen, other than Running Scared, which I'm going to endorse?
Wild Strawberries is great. I don't really know what a Blu-ray transfer will do to... I don't know. It's a beautiful looking film. Sven Nykvist's black and white cinematography, of course. But, it is sort of an interesting Blu-ray upgrade. I feel like, put out... There are other films. There are other Criterion films I would rather see, but I don't know how their process works. So I'm sure... I mean, they always have good reasons for what they do. So, Wild Strawberries on Blu-ray, a good thing. I just don't know if I really need to go past my Hulu Plus.
All right. Danny, anything?
I saw Snitch.
What did you think about that?
Well, The Rock is, as we learn in Pain and Gain, he's a good actor.
Yeah. Oh, God. Danny, have you seen Fast 6?
No.
Dude, do it.
I'm sure he's good in it.
Do it now.
Yeah. And he's good in Snitch. It's sort of an odd movie because the director's previous film was called Felon, and it starred Stephen Dorff. And it was just kind of this, like, intense and gritty movie about prison culture. And it was often very brutal, and it ended with like a title card, almost kind of giving the movie this feeling of like a social message drama about like prison. And Snitch is like oddly familiar in it ends with a title card. I can't remember what it is now, but it's like it's very heavy-handed as like a social issue drama starring The Rock. So it's kind of this like funny concept. It would be more interesting if it were like less boring because it's a little bit boring.
He just plays a regular guy in that film, right?
Yeah, it's like he's like a stunningly regular man. He like owns like a construction company or something. There's like a good early scene where he's about to drive home in his huge Cadillac SUV or something, Escalade, I think. Okay. And sees a guy working late, and he gets out of his car and like helps him. He's like, "Yeah, I'm the CEO, but I can help people if I want to." He's like, "I'm a normal guy,
just a guy." And so I go home and take a bed.
And then I think maybe his son like sells ecstasy and then he has to get him out of prison.
Yeah, I just remember that I read a New Yorker article about like the forced minimums and turning kids into snitches and like the way that like this girl was murdered because they figured out she was a snitch. And then this movie comes out and I'm like, is that like the big budget Hollywood remake of that article?
Yeah, it's really serious. Hilarious. About like
it's actually based Yeah, it's actually based on interviews that somebody did for Frontline, I believe. But I guess at the film's release, there was sort of the joke about how it was a little dramatized from the interviews. Yeah, because isn't there a scene where like a truck blows up or something?
Yeah, I would say it gets pretty action heavy at the end.
Right.
To chase with a truck. but a lot of the first hour is like The Rock meeting with people to try to get them to get his kid out of prison. I think Susan Sarandon has a couple scenes. Mm-hmm. And she's like, yeah, I'm not going to take your case. I don't think it's a good one. And The Rock is like, come on, Susan Sarandon. Like, there are rapists getting lesser sentences, you know?
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay, well, let's move into the theatrical releases. Two big films coming out this coming weekend. We have Man of Steel, Zack Snyder's Superman origin story film, produced by Christopher Nolan, starring Henry Cavill, Amy Adams, Michael Shannon, Russell Crowe. I actually have a friend who got to see this movie on Thursday. And he said he liked it.
Cool.
You know, take his word for it, I guess.
Yeah, my review of it will be up on the site in probably
24
like,
hours.
No, I'm minutes. Seeing it on Tuesday, so it'll be up on like Wednesday or so.
Yeah, he wrote a review for his personal blog, and apparently it's embargoed, but no one ever told him. So he got a very insistent but politely worded letter from Warner Brothers.
Okay. Oh, nice.
Yeah. Bizarre. But I'm looking forward to it greatly. Like I said, this is one of my most anticipated of the summer, and between all the new material that's come out and him talking about it, it sounds like I might not have misplaced that ambition. That's not what I was talking about. Anticipation.
Your ambitious anticipation.
I don't know what I'm going to do with this anticipation.
Look at you looking forward to Superman. How ambitious you are. You're a real go-getter, Brian.
Ain't I just. The other film coming out is This Is the End.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, could be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jordan has seen it and he was a fan. So,
all right, sweet.
Sure, it has comedic elements.
That's probably. So yeah, that's what's coming out. I'm not going to openly warn anyone away from anything, but I would definitely probably see Superman, Man of Steel first. Hopefully, the people don't like misconstrue Superman, the new Man of Steel movie, as a prequel to Iron Man.
Do you think the Bling Ring will make as much as Man of Steel?
Probably. It does have Emma Watson in it.
Yeah,
yes. She's made more money than Superman at the box office.
She has. Like, she's a proven box office draw. It has nothing to do with the property she was attached to.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the all-time best-selling 7-book series might have pushed a few tickets.
I think that probably was like 15%.
Okay.
You know, that brought in the stragglers, but she brought in the main bucks. So let's talk about what we've watched, and then we can be on our way. Danny, lay it on us. What have you watched that you think we should check out?
Oh, happily. I watched a kind of interesting film yesterday called The Candidate from 1972.
Please continue.
Yeah, okay. So it stars Robert Redford as this kind of small-town lawyer, and he gets approached by Peter Boyle to run for Senate with the intention that he has no chance of beating the incumbent, so he'll be able to kind of just say whatever he wants and, continue being this very idealistic sort of political personality. And then the race gets more complicated, and he has to end up trying to win the election, which sort of compromises his ideals. And the movie, part of its interest is it was actually a screenwriter worked as a political speechwriter, and I don't think he's written a screenplay since. So this movie was kind of just his project about putting what he knew about writing political speeches into a film. And the movie does have a kind of documentary-like appeal in that there's very little to the pacing that sort of suggests this intense election. It's more just these very kind of slow, dull conversations about how we're going to prepare for a debate or how we're going to structure this TV ad. But in those details, it kind of turns out to be a pretty unique film. I would recommend The Candidate from 1972.
All right.
And Nick?
Okay, I'm going to go with something a little more recent. I watched several films since we last recorded. The best of them, I think, is a motion picture by the title of Trouble Every Day, which is written and directed by Claire Denis, who, you know, we've discussed on the show in the past. I've talked about how I'm a fan of her work. I think Danny has said as much, too.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, though, unfortunately.
So this is a 2001 movie, which is, like most of her work, has a very, you know, a very precisely structured, very sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? A very, let's just say precisely structured.
Meticulous?
Plot. Meticulous plot, which relates to, if not vampires, at least cannibals.
You've been kind of on a vampire kick, I feel, recently.
Have I?
Didn't you watch Vampire and then you were really looking forward to the new Jim Jarmusch film?
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know this was about vampires when I watched it.
Oh, okay.
Or at least before I watched it. You figure out what you anyway
when you're watching it at some point. Yeah. You figure it out.
What's the thing about this movie is that it asks you, like all of her films, it asks you to kind of just flow with its unique sense of logic and trust that everything will kind of make sense in the end. And it does. And it's because the film is structured so perfectly. And Denis is such an impeccable visual stylist. And she's such a confident visual storyteller that I counted something like 20 minutes goes by in this movie. And the first 20 minutes of this movie, there's maybe 45 seconds worth of dialogue. The rest is all dictated by her compositions and her editing and kind of the kind of invigorating, intoxicating nature of it, the way that you're sort of, you feel like you could almost fall into these images or reach out and touch them. And the story that's delivered through there, it's a, you know, multi-perspective, sort of non-chronological narrative. But the way that she puts her faith in the audience and is trust them to be wise enough and actually goes out and executes it to deliver on her promise is sort of astounding. I watched this movie and I was stunned. And then I looked it up afterward and I saw that a lot of people don't really care for it, which I find interesting. I thought it was going to be really acclaimed. I saw it has a 44% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 6 out of 10 and a 6 out of 10 rating on IMDb. This was after I had tweeted about it using the M word. So yeah, you know, I kind of who's whistling?
That's Danny.
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know you were I didn't know you could whistle.
I was just shocked by those Rotten Tomatoes scores. You gotta be kidding me.
Okay. yeah, so I'm really just so in love with this film. Despite this movie, I hate Vincent Gallo. This movie stars Vincent Gallo, but it did not bother me in the least. That's how good this film is.
I was about to say, I'm not usually, you know, not a great, you know what, fuck that guy.
Yeah, no, he's horrible. But his performance here is very good, and there are some images in this movie which are absolutely horrific. Stomach-churningly horrific, but they don't feel at all sort of the way they're integrated into Trouble Every Day is not at all unjustifiable. It is actually, I mean, it's masterful the way that these are sort of, they sort of spike the movie instead of kind of weighing it down.
So it's kind of like in Hannibal, the NBC television show.
I only watched a pilot of that and then I moved on with my life.
Really?
Yeah, because it was awful.
What?
I thought you were talking about Ridley Scott's Hannibal, which is decidedly not subtle.
No, I was talking about the show. You didn't like the show?
I watched the pilot and I thought this is garbage.
Really?
Do you watch it? Or?
Yeah, I kind of got hooked on it this weekend.
You know, a lot of people like it, and I am curious because I do quite enjoy the character of Hannibal Lecter, and I love Mads Mikkelsen, but I watched the pilot, and I just thought, oh boy, this stinks to high heaven.
Was there anything particularly about the pilot that you didn't like?
Hugh Dancy being the worst actor who has ever lived.
Really? That bothered. I didn't have a problem with him.
Okay.
He is the main character, so if that is a problem. But I mean, I like it.
Maybe he acts like less of a mentally retarded person later in the series.
I don't know. I liked him in the pilot. I've grown to like him more. So
and
I don't know,
I don't say that to be mean. I mean, he truly acts like he like there's something deeply wrong with him, but not in a convincing way.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say there is. I mean, that's a big.
Oh no! It's horrible. It's overacting to the extreme. What I saw, maybe he improves.
Maybe I don't know. I had only decided to check it out because so many people told me it was good.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know, what the hell else am I going to do with my time? So I watched the first episode, and then I was immediately like, all right, let's keep this going.
All right, maybe I'll watch the second. But anyway, Trouble Every Day, great film. And I'm working my way through her filmography chronologically, which has been a great pleasure. So next is Friday Night. Maybe if I like it enough, I'll report back on it.
And that is the sequel to Friday, correct?
Yes. Next Friday. There's Friday, next Friday, and then Friday Night.
Exactly. Yeah. Also, a prequel to Friday Night Lights.
Yes.
TV show. Anyway,
this joke is still funny.
Oh God, I'll add some laughter in post. My selection. I watched The Road to Perdition. Danny, I think you saw me tweeting about this.
Sam Mendes.
Yeah, someone had been talking about Skyfall, and I remember really liking The Road to Perdition, and so I decided to put it on. And I still
is there
really
a the
movie.
In the title?
Is there a the in the title? Am I screwing up my definite articles again?
There's no the. It's
when,
just
when did this happen? This happened with Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah,
I think
constantly. Probably some other stuff too.
The Before Midnight.
Before the Midnight.
Before the Midnight.
Anyway. Yes. Before a sunrise, you know, any sunrise.
Mm.
The Road to... Oh, shit, I did it again. Road to Perdition. Tom Hanks plays an enforcer for the Irish section of the Mafia. And he gets his son embroiled in some trouble and has to embark on a... I don't know, not really cross-country, but a road trip to save both their lives. Fantastic film. Love the score. Love the score. Acting is great. From everyone involved, and the production design is also beautiful. I tweeted about how much I love the rain sloughing off the brims of fedoras. There's just something like it's a luscious looking film. It's very beautiful.
Yeah, it's about half a good movie. Yeah.
Oh, really, Nick?
Yeah.
What's the half you don't like?
Pretty much everything outside of the way it's designed, I would say.
Really,
I think that really up until. It's weird. Up until Skyfall, which you'd sort of expect to be more extravagant in this sense, I think that Sam Mendes has been really guilty of over-directing his scenes and kind of...
I mean, that's a criticism I can't really
My biggest problems is... this has always stuck out to me. There's a very powerful, or almost powerful scene in the movie where Tom Hanks is running home because he knows his wife and son are about to be killed. And then you see a shot of the gun in the window... And then you see the gun be fired, I think is how it goes. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes.
You know, it's just, the movie is filled with things like that, which kind of rub me the wrong way. Same with Jude Law's character, which feels...
Oh, no, I love Jude Law's character.
See, this movie is based on a graphic novel, which is fascinating because you wouldn't... You know, when you think of a graphic novel, you think of superheroes, but that is like that is the comic element of the movie. That is what feels like it comes from a comic book, and it's just so... I don't know. It's weird because there's so much about that movie that's good, but then there's so much about that movie that's not. You know, man? I mean, obviously you don't.
No, I love it. So.
Complex feelings towards it. I'll watch it again soon enough. I will say, though, I was actually talking with my dad about this today. Paul Newman is really one of the few American actors who... did not degrade himself as an older performer.
Yeah.
Like Al Pacino.
Al Pacino, Robert De Niro.
Paul Newman, I mean, I even said, even though his last movie is Cars, which is not like a great movie, you could do worse than your last role being a Pixar movie, and he's good in that too.
No, and he brought a lot to that film. He's the voice of a car. I don't know why I'm saying that, but it's true.
So I do appreciate how it is a really great performance from him, and it's not, you know, it was just something like 6 years before he died.
Yeah.
So that's good.
I think it's also, I mean, it's kind of a weird companion piece-ish to After Earth, and just it's another movie that deals with fathers and sons. It's another like father and son, like father teaching son to do this thing. It just lets you know, like, I hated the relationship between the father and son in After Earth, and I know that that's a problem that a lot of movies have, but this movie I think does a really good job of kind of balancing out that authoritarian figure, but also like the nurturer, and I don't know. I like
you know that the actors in After Earth are actually
right. That's the weirdest part about saying I hated the relationship between them. It's like I basically am just damning their entire.
I bet you didn't even know that, did you?
No,
you
thought, how could I?
Thought I would never believe these two people as father son. No way they are in real life.
If you were to have not told me who they were, like if they were any other people, and I had watched that movie, like if I came from another country where Will Smith isn't well known, and I didn't read all this stuff about it, I would be like, yeah, they really could have done better with the casting for the chemistry between father and son.
Mm. And let's not forget the movie's really subtle use of water.
Oh god,
sorry, anyway. I don't mean to rain on your parade, but
rain anyway,
and it'll slough off your fedora. So it's all good.
It will. I do have a fedora. I could never rock a fedora as well as people then could, or people who are in a movie then can. So let's just end this conversation. Where can we be found in the meantime, Danny?
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And Nick?
Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, TheFilmStage.com, and somewhere off the islands of Greece.
And I can be found at DearFilm.net, my personal blog, TheFilmStage.com, and Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So join us next week when we will be talking about one of the most pumped-up anticipated films of the summer, Man of Steel by director Zack Snyder.